This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, we kick off a mini-series of interviews with some of last night's Emmy winners and maybe a couple of nominees. We begin with Bryan Cranston, who won the award for Best Lead Actor in a Drama Series for his performance as Walter White in AMC's Breaking Bad, which won the Emmy for Best Drama Series.
Chemistry is, well, technically, chemistry is the study of matter. But I prefer to see it as the study of change.
In the pilot of Breaking Bad, high school teacher Walter White failed to interest his chemistry students in the study of change. But over the course of the series, Walt himself came to exemplify radical change, using his knowledge of chemistry to become a master meth cook and transforming himself into a notorious outlaw, willing to kill when necessary to keep his operation running. Acting is also about change and transformation, and Bryan Cranston is a master. While Breaking Bad fans were watching him portray Walter White in the final episodes of the series, Cranston was already undergoing another transformation, playing President Lyndon Johnson in the play All the Way, for which he won a Tony this year. Breaking Bad concluded its fifth and final season in September of 2013. I spoke with him a few months later in March. So I want to play what I think is one of the just best scenes from Breaking Bad. And this has become a kind of iconic scene, and it's the one who knocks scene. And just to set it up, Walt's wife, Skyler, at this point in season 4, episode 6, knows that Walt's cooking meth. And she knows that Walt's in danger, and she believes, she has no idea the evil acts that Walt has done. She doesn't know that in addition to cooking meth, that you've killed people, that you've done horrible things.
Well, you know, horrible to one man is necessary to another.
That's right. So anyway, she's thinking, you know, my husband, he's just like cooking meth. He did it for a reason, to help the family. So, Walt, what you've got to do is just go to the police. So in this scene, she's trying to convince you that that's all you need to do is, like, turn yourself in and explain what happened. So here is a very famous scene from Breaking Bad with Anna Gunn as Skyler and my guest Bryan Cranston as Walter White.
Walt, I've said it before. If you are in danger, we go to the police.
No, I don't want to hear about the police.
I do not say that lightly. I know what it could do to this family, but if it's the only real choice we have, if it's either that or you getting shot when you open your front door,
I don't want to hear about the
you're
police.
You're not some hardened criminal, Walt. You are in over your head.
No.
That's what we tell them, and that's the truth.
No, it's not the truth.
Of course it is. The school teacher, cancer, desperate for money.
Okay, we're done here.
Roped into working for, unable to even quit. You told me that yourself, Walt. Jesus, what was I thinking? Walt, please, let's both of us stop trying to justify this whole thing and admit you're in danger.
Who are you talking to right now? Who is it you think you see? Do you know how much I make a year? I mean, even if I told you, you wouldn't believe it. Do you know what would happen if I suddenly decided to stop going into work? A business big enough that it could be listed on the NASDAQ goes belly up. Disappears. It ceases to exist without me. No, you clearly don't know who you're talking to, so let me clue you in. I am not in danger, Skyler. I am the danger. A guy opens his door and gets shot, and you think that of me? No. I am the one who knocks.
I just can't hear that scene too many times.
Wow.
It's so good.
I haven't heard that in a while. It's,
really?
It's good to revisit that.
That's such a great scene. So when you first read those lines, which are so terrific, did you know how you were going to read them? Like, did you try them all kinds of different ways before getting the version that we heard?
No. And, you know, listening to that again, it's just a testament to the writing staff of Breaking Bad, led by Vince Gilligan. And in that one scene, you have two opposing viewpoints that are equally valid from their point of view. Skyler is worried about her family. She makes a very pragmatic pitch. Just confess. Stop it now. Don't do this. You're going to put yourself and us in danger. But Walt, by then, is too far along in his journey his ego has been opened, and he is fully realizing his sense of power, and he likes it, and he is not about to, you know, go back into the shell that he originally came out of. And he's taking her comments as demeaning, as pejorative, that you're not who you say you are. You're not a powerful person. You're a little school teacher. Just go back to that. And all I'm hearing is, you're not a man. You're not this powerful, great Wizard of Oz behind the curtain. You're just Walter White, this little man. You know, and he's so far beyond that at that moment. He now has to express himself with his full range of hubris, and that's what comes out.
And that's that scene is a great example of how your voice changed while playing Walter White, because it starts off kind of similar in the voice that you're talking in now, and it ends up in that much deeper, huskier voice.
You know, a lower voice is always a little more intimidating, isn't it? You know, has a little more gravitas to it. And so I wanted to drop it just maybe not a full register, but, you know, something noticeable.
Walt saw himself as bland, and others saw him that way too, until he turned into Heisenberg, the meth cooking genius. Had you felt that casting director saw you that way, saw you as bland as an actor? Or, you know, sort of, or physically bland, you know, if not like in terms of like your talent.
Yes. No, I have a very fortunate look for an actor. You can't really categorize me. My looks aren't striking. And so therefore I am more capable of sliding into looking like other people, more chameleon-like, as opposed to, let's say, John Hamm, who is this handsome, striking, black-haired, you know, chiseled kind of looking guy. Well, you know, that's great for John, and he's a friend, and I love him. But I don't know that you would buy him as Walter White. He would have to fight against his looks in order to do that. So there's a larger range of roles that are available to me than are available to John Hamm, simply because of physicality. And I love that.
What did you have in your life to draw on to create Walt's insecurity, his anger, his greed, his ability to lie, his ability to lose his conscience and be able to kill people with a pretty minimal amount of remorse? I know that's too many traits to answer in full, but, you know, these are not admirable traits. So where did you go to find that?
I understood where Walter White was at the beginning. I couldn't understand where he was at the end because I didn't know exactly where he was going to go, how deep he was going to go. So at the beginning was the only quest for me to find. Initially, I had a very difficult time in finding the emotional core of him, which is where I go. That's what I seek when I take on a character. For Hal in Malcolm in the Middle, it was fear. He was afraid of everything. And that lent itself to good humor, but it was also very honest, is that he was afraid of everything, of being a bad father, losing his job, not pleasing his wife, you know, and everything. Spiders, heights. In Lyndon Johnson, it's seeking love. He needs, craves, he must be fed love. He feels he's unloved at his core. And so he's constantly doing things out of wanting to be approved and loved. With Walt, it was more difficult because I kept looking and I couldn't find it. And it was frustrating me until it dawned on me that he didn't even know how he felt because of depression. The depression he was feeling over missed opportunities in his life created sort of a calloused cocoon of his emotions. He couldn't tap into his emotions. He was numb. And therefore, once I found that, that spoke volumes. It was like, oh, got it. I got it. He's given up. He's gone to seed, and therefore, that's where the taking the color out of my hair and my face. I didn't want any color in his life. The way he walked, the way he was overweight, he had pudginess. He was very pale. And then the diagnosis of terminal lung cancer came, and ironically, gave him new life because it exploded. It was like a dynamite exploded that cocoon. And all of a sudden, his emotions were spewed everywhere. And that's why he became sloppy. In what you just played, that scene, his ego wouldn't allow him to just let her talk logically about giving himself up. He needed to tell her how important I am. Do you know how much money I make? You have any idea? You know, so he had to give it back to her.
And he wants credit. He wants credit.
He wants credit.
He's a genius cooking meth, and he wants credit for it. And he's figured out how to run an illegal business. Of course, he can't take the credit, but you know, he wants Hank to know, and he wants his wife to know.
That's right.
Fans of Breaking Bad, like me, really miss Walter White, your character. What's it like for you to no longer be thinking about what Walt might do in a situation, how he'd react, to no longer have him in your head?
Well, it's bittersweet because it was an extraordinary time in my life. It changed my life, and I'll forever be grateful for that. I'm also happy that it ended when it did, because the effect that had was so wonderful that everybody comes up to me and says, I wish there were more, I want more, I want more. And that's always a much better position to be in than having people say, I want less of you. is that show still on the air? Oh my God, you know. So you want to be able to go out on your terms, and the man who created the show, who I'll be eternally grateful to, Vince Gilligan, felt that this was the right amount of hours to tell this story.
As Walter White, you became physically transformed. Walter White starts as a kind of blending in the background chemistry high school teacher. And over time, as he cooks more meth and starts doing some very evil deeds, he becomes physically transformed. I mean, part of it's the cancer. Your head is bald. You have this, like, how do you describe the kind of beard that he has?
It's actually called a Van Dyke, which a goatee is just the hair on the chin, a la a goat. But the combination of the mustache connecting in with the hair on the chin is called a Van Dyke. So it started off as this, what I called an impotent mustache, which I wanted Walter White at the very beginning to look impotent and weak. And I wanted people to look at the mustache and think to themselves, why bother? Either shave it or grow it or do something. And I wanted that kind of ambiguity to his look and to make him feel confused and unnoteworthy, and as he grew in power, that the look would also grow in power, and we discovered that the most powerful look that a man can have, the most aggressive look, is no hair on the head and facial hair.
So you had to live with that version of Walt in your regular life. You couldn't grow that beard every week or grow hair every week. So you looked like evil Walt, you know, in your personal life. It wasn't a prosthetic you could take off or anything that you could change. I'm assuming the beard was really yours.
The beard was real. Yeah.
So I'm wondering what it was like to look in the mirror and see some of Walt in there, because that was Walt's look and not Bryan Cranston's.
Yes, but unlike other actors, I don't look in the mirror that often, quite frankly. most of our day is looking out from our own eyes, so we're not seeing ourselves and as others do. And yes, it was a look that became rather iconic, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, it was very pragmatic. I knew that the character was going to go through chemotherapy, and we discussed losing the hair, and it was brought up by Vince. He says, "Well, do you want to do a bald cap?" I said, "No, I'm gonna shave it. Let's do it." And so I just shaved my head.
Let's hear the scene that helped you get your starring role in Breaking Bad. You were in The X-Files, which Vince Gilligan, the creator of Breaking Bad, had been working on. And in this episode, which apparently made a really big impression on Vince Gilligan, you guest starred as Patrick Crump, who's a racist, anti-Semite, seemingly deranged, and...
But otherwise, sweet guy.
Nice guy. And he's trapped, FBI agent Mulder, David Duchovny, in a car and has him driving at high speed. And so your character thinks that he's a victim of some kind of weird conspiracy that's gotten deep into his head, that's like embedded into his head. Mm-hmm. And what we don't know yet is that he actually is. Actually is a victim of the government. Yeah. So anyway, so here you are in the car, in the back seat. David Duchovny is driving, and David Duchovny is Agent Mulder. Speaks first, because your wife has already died of this whatever it is that you think is trapped in your head and was also trapped in hers.
I'm sorry about your wife.
I'm sure you are. You and the rest of your Jew FBI.
Crump.
Oh, yeah. You think I don't know, huh? You think I'm just some ignorant pudnucker, don't you? But I get it, man! I see what this is. I am not sick, and I do not have the flu. Vicky and me were just some kind of government guinea pigs.
You think the government did this to you?
Oh, hell yeah, who else? You see it all the time on the TV. They're dropping Agent Orange. They're putting radiation in little retarded kids' gonads. Oh yeah, you sons of bitches sneaking around my woods that night, I seen you. You think I don't know?
Well, on behalf of the International Jewish Conspiracy, I just need to inform you that we're almost out of gas.
David Duchovny and my guest Bryan Cranston in a scene from The X-Files from 1998. Was that an unusual part for you at the time, this racist, extremist, tormented on the verge of hysteria kind of guy? Were you paranoid and threatening?
No. No, I made the rounds of guest starring roles on many, many television series and usually playing the bad guy of the week, which is basically the role that men had in series television, as opposed to women playing usual victim of the week kind of thing. and that's why another reason why Breaking Bad broke the mold. But there you find another example in the writing that Vince was able to do, is that he went another level deeper than what you would expect. And that's why X-Files became the show that it did, with that kind of sensibility behind it, where an average show would have written Crump to be a nice guy, a sweet guy. Therefore, the audience would want David Duchovny to save this man. He's a nice man. But the audience wouldn't be invested in that. It would just be an automatic, he's a nice guy. But because he wrote me as this despicable character, saying awful things, it put the emotional dilemma in his central character. It gave the power to Duchovny, which is absolutely right. Do I save this man simply because he's a human being, when what he really wants to do is pull over, stop, and say, Crump, see ya. Go ahead and die, because you're an awful person, and no one's going to miss you. But he can't, because he's human, and despite the actions of this man, he is still worth saving. So that's the germ of Breaking Bad. That was the seed, that he felt that I would be right for this role because Crump was a character that was doing despicable things and still was able to convey a sense of vulnerability and to receive sympathy. And that's what he felt that Walter White needed.
Okay, one more clip I want to squeeze in here. A lot of us noticed you on Seinfeld in your recurring role as Dr. Tim Whatley, Jerry's dentist. And mm-hmm. we've stitched two scenes together here. In the first, you meet Jerry and George at the coffee shop, where you reveal you've converted to Judaism. And in mm-hmm. the second scene, you're in your dentist's office working on Jerry's teeth, playing up how Jewish you've become. So in the opening of this clip, which again is in the coffee shop, Jerry and George ask you what's up.
I'll tell you what's up. I'm a Jew.
Excuse me?
I'm a Jew. I finished converting 2 days ago.
Oh, well. Welcome aboard.
Thanks. So I'll see you tomorrow?
Yeah, I have a cavity lower left.
Hey, were you just at the health club?
Oh, yeah.
No, we must have just missed you.
Oh, well, I didn't do much. I just sat in the sauna. You know, it was more like a Jewish workout. That's it. Now, which reminds me, did you hear the one about the rabbi and the farmer's daughter? Huh? Those aren't matzo balls. What?
Tim, do you think you should be making jokes like that?
Why not? I'm Jewish, remember?
I know, but...
Jerry, it's our sense of humor that sustained us as a people for 3,000 years.
5,000.
5,000, even better. Okay. Chrissy, give me a shtickle of fluorite.
Did you have to ask what shtickle meant?
No, I knew what it meant.
It's a little bit off, yeah. So you're very funny in that. Did you? I read that you did stand up for a while early in your career. Is that right?
I did. I did it in for about 9 months in 1981, I believe it was, and I did it solely for the purpose of overcoming fear. As I looked at that and I said to myself, oh, man, that's got to be the scariest thing to do. Just stand there. There's a microphone and a light on you, and that's it. It's all you. And so I wanted to do that, and I got into the idea of going from club to club. I was never paid for it, nor should I have been, because I never rose above the level of mediocrity. And but it was a great, great experience for me, very humbling. And my respect and admiration for those who do it for a living, like Jerry, was just, you know, enormous.
Tell us something about what your act was like.
It was observational. I did a series of, you know, talking about, you know, how out of Detroit, there's been a reduction in the amount of cars that are being sold. And, you know, they should really appeal to men to buy more cars because women are now becoming the decision makers. They're the one who are emotionally connected to it, and they convince their husbands or boyfriends, this is the car I want to get. But in order to get men to buy cars, we're such simple beasts. All you need to do is name these cars after women's body parts, and they'll buy them. Like the cute little Ford nipple. It's peppy. You know? And I went on down a list of them. You know, or that import, that very safe import, the Volvo. You know. And I finished with, and who can resist? And guys, once you step into the new Dodge Vagina, you'll never want to get out. You know, I mean, it was, I don't know.
How did it go over?
Sometimes I got some decent laughs, and other times it was crickets. But then you never know, because the times that I had been given were sometimes, you know, 1:48 in the morning. You're the last one. Turn off the lights when you're done.
Yeah.
So everybody's drunk already, and so you might even get great laughs there, and then you take that same material to a sober audience, and they go, not so funny. So, and you saw why.
it's a great story. So, you grew up just outside of L.A. Your mother had been a radio actress before you were born. Your father was an actor. He appeared in episodes of some syndicated shows that I used to watch. I mean, they were in syndication by the time I watched them when I was growing up. Annie Oakley, Highway Patrol, The Gale Storm Show, Oh Susanna. So what were your father's ambitions? Like, you've become an extraordinarily successful actor. I know what I know about him through looking him up on IMDb. He's not a well-known actor. Mm-hmm. What did he want to be?
Well, I think he wanted to be a star. He wanted to go out to California from Chicago, where he was mostly raised, and after the war, and hit it big time. And he did a lot of radio shows, and that's where he met my mother, doing radio. And they, for a time, they lived in an apartment building in Hollywood, and Anne Bancroft was nearby, and Mike Connors was nearby, and all these young actors just starting out and hoping, you know, that they would have a shot at a career. And it's either kismet or hard luck, you know, for most actors. The life is, it looks like, you know, if you looked at the sheet of an earthquake, it's severe, and it could be, you know, a steady line and then sharp movement upwards and then steady line again. It's very difficult to sustain. And I think because of my dad's experience through the gauntlet that is an acting career, I think it helped me just prepare better for it, that my goals were to be a good working actor.
So your parents divorced when you were 12, and you stayed with your mother, who had trouble paying the mortgage, so your house was foreclosed on, and then you were sent to your grandparents?
Yes. My brother and I were shipped off to our grandparents, my maternal grandparents, who were retired. He was a retired baker. They're both German immigrants. And they lived on a gentleman's farm, about a half acre or to an acre, in a community called Yucaipa, California. And it was kind of way out of there. And we went begrudgingly, and we stayed with them a year until my mother was able to get back on her feet and get a house and get a job and bring us back together. And after the year, and it was time to move back with our mother, my brother and I didn't want to go, even though our grandfather and grandmother were strict disciplinarians. And I think that's why we didn't want to go. We learned something that we didn't even know we needed. We needed that kind of consistency and care and direction and responsibility. And I firmly believe that that's where I picked up my work habits and my ethic toward work. And because we had chores every day. We were out there, we'd have to kill chickens and drain the blood and pluck the feathers and cut them up and do all that stuff. Next door to us was an egg ranch, and we had part-time jobs over there collecting eggs and trapping coyotes and all kinds of stuff. It was an extraordinary year that a city dweller that I was wouldn't have had it not been for that unfortunate, messy breakup.
Well, what's the story behind this, if you're willing to share it? I think you didn't talk to your father for 10 years, or he didn't talk to you for 10 years following your parents' divorce.
Yeah. It was really... It was disruptive and dark, and there was a really dichotomous relationship that we had with our parents, that up until about when I was 10 years old, it was wonderful. My dad was always coaching our basketball in Little League and with us, and my mom was the team mom and making our Halloween costumes and an Avon lady and always with the PTA and very active. And this breakup of theirs just destroyed both of them to a core. My father left, and I didn't see him for 10 years. I saw him again when I was 22 years old. And it just devastated my mother that he was the love of her life, and ultimately he rejected her. And she became an alcoholic. And it was a desperate life that she led for many, many years after that. And, of course, the relationship that I had with her changed because I was growing up and she was, and we were growing apart naturally anyway. But then you added on and compounded this experience that was just devastating. My father readily admits that he went crazy. He just went nuts. He had this classic midlife crisis that couldn't cope, was dissatisfied with the lack of attention he was getting in his career, and that it wasn't going in anywhere near where he wanted it to go, and it boiled over, and he exploded, and he took off. And when you're a kid, when you're 10, 11, 12, you have nothing to relate it to. And people come and people go, and you know, in those days, it was the 60s, late 60s that by then, and divorced couples were still an anomaly. And you used to look at a house, oh, they're divorced. The people who live there got divorced. Ooh. And so you don't quite know what to make of it all. And the only point in looking back on your childhood and going to therapy and try to put the pieces of the puzzle back together that were crudely and aggressively, you know, cast off the table is to make your life better as an adult, and so that you don't pass on to your children the same problems that your parents passed on to you. So, that was my quest.
Your father's 90 now. Are you in the position of helping to care for him?
I am. And I do. And I'm happy to. I'm glad I'm in the position to be able to help him and support him. And he's a different man, too, now. As we go through our passages, to be able to be open to them and to accept these changes in ourselves and others and to forgive. And the person who needs to forgive the most is himself, because he doesn't recognize that man who did what he did and left his responsibilities. He laments about it and talks about it on rare occasion, but when he does, it's with disdain for his own sense, you know, for himself. And then he mostly expresses his gratitude for his children getting back in touch with him and rekindling a relationship.
You found him? Is that what happened? You found him?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Was it hard to find him?
No. No, it wasn't. You know, Hollywood basically is a pretty small community when you think about it.
Had he still been acting? Could you, like...
No. Mm-hmm. No, he was now writing mostly for a living, and not only in theatrical areas, but speeches for politicians and mm-hmm. Industrial materials and films and things like that. And that's how he made his living.
Well, early in your career, you did commercials.
Uh-huh.
And one of them was for Preparation H, the hemorrhoidal creams and suppositories. So let's just give a listen to my guest, Bryan Cranston, doing a commercial for Preparation H.
Now you can relieve inflamed hemorrhoidal tissue with the oxygen action of Preparation H. It accelerates absorption of pure oxygen to help shrink swelling of inflamed hemorrhoidal tissue, as it often relieves pain and itch for hours. Preparation H with oxygen action.
Do you know what oxygen action was?
No, some buzzword that someone came up with. You know, I justified doing that because I said, well, I'm not the guy who actually has the hemorrhoid, so I'm the expert trying to help others.
Oh, but, okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so yeah. No, because I was wondering, like, were you worried that people would see you and they'll go, oh, yeah, the hemorrhoid guy?
No. No, unless, you know, there's very few commercial campaigns that strike a chord and become iconic. Other ones are easily forgotten.
I would not recognize your voice from that commercial. And if you just showed it to me, I don't think I would have recognized your face either.
Yeah, maybe not. I've changed quite a bit. I noticed the voice is a couple octaves higher.
You're also wearing these big, like, 80s glasses in it, so.
Yeah. I also don't think my testicles dropped yet. That was quite a long time ago.
I want to ask you your favorite TV shows and movies of all time, maybe the ones that had the biggest influence on you in your formative years growing up.
Well, the movie that had the most impact on me was one that probably no one else will select, and that's because it's very personal. And that's Cat Ballou with Jane Fonda and Lee Marvin.
He sings in it, doesn't he?
Well, no, that's you're thinking of Paint Your Wagon.
I'm thinking of Paint Your Wagon. Yes,
yeah.
I am.
Yes. No, and Lee Marvin should never have sung in any movie ever. But no, in Cat Ballou, it wasn't so much the movie as it was what I was going through at the time. It was, I believe it was early 1968 or late 1967. And my parents were going through a terrible time. And this was right before their breakup, the official splitting off. And my dad had leased a bar and coffee shop in the Corbin Bowl on Ventura Boulevard in Tarzana in California. And he was running this, and it was not doing well. And it was another thing that was going down fast, and that exacerbated the problems they were already having. And right next door to this cafe, and then we were young, I was 12, was the Corbin Theater. And they were playing Cat Ballou at this very critical time when we were there most of the night because we did our homework on one of the coffee shop tables. And when we were done, we were able to go over to the theater, and they made arrangements with the theater owner. We got in free, and they gave him a free lunch and that sort of thing. And my brother and I would go and watch this so that we can escape the tension of what my parents were doing. And we got to memorize this movie. Every single line of this movie we memorized. And we would go back home, and when they were still arguing, we would be in our room and we would do the entire movie over again. We would play the movie in our heads and we'd act out the parts. And so from an early age, we were using that theatrical experience as an escape mechanism, as a way of almost like our acceptable drug of choice. We were escaping an emotional crisis by reinventing, you know, art. You know, I look at it in retrospect, and I have such fondness for this movie, I can't accurately say whether it was a good movie or not. It was a great movie to me because of what it meant.
Bryan Cranston, it has been so great to talk with you and also to just hear your voice speaking as yourself. It's been so much fun.
I am the one who talks.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. And thank you, Terry. It was a delight.
I love talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bryan Cranston recorded in March. Last night, he won the Emmy for Outstanding Actor in a Drama Series for his performance in AMC's Breaking Bad, which won for Best Drama Series. Our mini-series of interviews with this week's Emmy Award winners continues tomorrow. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new album by Elvin Bishop. This is Fresh Air.